Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brett Kaufman with the ACLU's National Security Project, who discusses his group's legal challenge to the Obama administration's use of drones in the targeted killing of American citizens. Carl J. Mayer, an attorney representing journalist Chris Hedges and six other plaintiffs, who talks about the latest court battle in their challenge to the government's power to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens linked with terrorism. And Marty Isaac, president of Connecticut Against Gun Violence Education Fund, who talks about the strengthening of firearms laws his group is advocating for in the Connecticut State Legislature in the wake of the Newtown School massacre. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In a deal to save the Indonesian rainforest, Asia Pulp and Paper, or APP, the world's third largest paper company, has agreed to stop clear-cutting and instead grow all its timber on plantations. The agreement will save the habitat of the Sumatran tiger and other tropical species. For years, eco-activist groups like Greenpeace have blasted APP as forest criminals for clear-cutting tropical forests to produce paper used to make consumer products like toilet paper, magazines, and buckets for Kentucky Fried Chicken. Rainforest defenders have run campaigns against the companies Mattel and Staples to pressure APP to reform its logging practices. Collectively, the campaigns had taken a toll on APP's corporate image. APP has hired the Forest Trust, a UK-based nonprofit organization that helps companies transform their timber supply chains and stop forest destruction. Forest Trust will design and oversee the paper company's new conservation policy, which will also impact APP's many contractors and suppliers across Asia. Forest Trust director Scott Poynton told Mother Jones magazine, "This would not have happened without the efforts of Greenpeace and other NGOs. We also don't think this could have happened without someone on the inside like us working with the company to figure out how to get there." Chefs for the Marcellus is a group that sprung up to defend the farmers in upstate New York who were supplying hundreds of new farms to fork restaurants. Many area farmers occupy the same land eyed by energy companies seeking to use hydraulic fracturing or fracking to extract rich natural gas deposits from the Marcellus shale formation in the Northeast, which has led to a new domestic energy boom. In New York, owners of new breweries, wineries, and organic dairies are worried about the negative impact of fracking operations on crops, livestock, and the farmers themselves. According to The Nation magazine, the only peer-reviewed report suggesting a link between fracking and illness in food animals was published in 2012 by Michelle Bamberger, an Ithaca veterinarian, and Robert Oswald, a professor of molecular medicine at Cornell's College of Veterinary Medicine. The authors studied 24 farmers in six shale gas states whose livestock experienced neurological, reproductive, and acute gastrointestinal problems. Exposed either accidentally or incidentally to fracking chemicals in the water or air, scores of animals have died. Environmental advocates believe the deaths of these farm animals constitute an early warning about the dangers of fracking. Predictably, the study was harshly attacked by the pro-fracking group Energy in Depth, claiming the study did not use strict scientific assessment or specific risks. There are a growing number of farmers and rural veterinarians who are afraid to speak out about the negative health effects of fracking for fear of retribution from neighbors with lucrative gas company leases or the threat of lawsuits stemming from food disparagement laws or from oil companies claiming defamation. Others have traded the risk of harm to their animals and farmland for the royalty checks already forthcoming from the energy companies. The former First Lady of France, Carla Bruni Sarkozy, created an uproar when she told Paris Vogue, "My generation does not need feminism." French women immediately started a Twitter campaign in protest with the hashtag, "Dear Carla Bruni, we need feminism because." Bruni, a former model, soon apologized, handing feminists a victory, countering the belief by some that French women already have it all with generous social benefits. Gender relations in France became a high-profile issue after the 2011 arrest of former IMF director Dominique Strauss-Kahn for allegedly sexually attacking a hotel maid. France provides 16 weeks of paid maternity leave and heavily subsidizes daycare for working mothers. Yet the nation has weak protections against sexual harassment. In a 2012 global survey on gender equity, France fell behind the Scandinavian countries, Germany, Ireland, and the United States. In the fallout from the Strauss-Kahn rape case, France enacted stronger sanctions against sexual harassment. France's newly elected socialist president, François Hollande, brought gender equity to the cabinet and reopened the Women's Rights Ministry after it had been closed for 30 years. In addition, all government ministers were recently sent to a 45-minute anti-sexism class. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
A confidential 16-page Justice Department memo referred to as the White Paper that considers the legal authority of the U.S. government to use unmanned aerial drones abroad was leaked to NBC News and released to the public on February 4th. The memo concludes that the U.S. government can order the killing of American citizens if they are believed to be senior operational leaders of Al-Qaeda or an associated force, even if there's no intelligence indicating they are engaged in an active plot to attack the U.S. The memo further argues for a broader concept of imminence, declaring the condition that an operational leader present an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States does not require the United States to have clear evidence that a specific attack on U.S. persons or interests will take place in the immediate future. To date, the public has been told that 3 U.S. citizens have been killed by drones: Samir Khan, Anwar al-Awlaki, and his 16-year-old son, Abdul Rahman al-Awlaki, were killed by U.S. drone strikes in Yemen during 2011. Against the backdrop of new questions about the U.S. drone program provoked by the memo, President Obama's nominee to head the CIA, John Brennan, was questioned by members of the Senate Intelligence Committee during confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill. During the hearing, Brennan, a holdover from the Bush administration, now Mr. Obama's counterterrorism chief and architect of the drone program, disturbingly refused to describe the practice of waterboarding of terrorism suspects, as practiced under Mr. Bush, as torture. The Obama administration's escalation of America's use of drones and its targeted killing of suspected terrorists across the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa in recent years has provoked increased opposition and anger abroad. Your reporter spoke with Brett Kaufman, National Security Fellow with the ACLU's National Security Project, who talks about his group's legal challenge to the government's right to assassinate U.S. citizens without charge, trial, or due process.
We filed a few lawsuits under the Freedom of Information Act, trying to get information about the government's targeted killing program, as well as any information the agencies have about the effects that program is having abroad, including civilian deaths. And so we filed a lawsuit here in New York seeking the Office of Legal Counsel memos that authorize the killing of Anwar al-Awlaki and any other legal memos and materials that discuss the government's claimed authority to target American citizens under this targeted killing program. The other lawsuit is in Washington, D.C., also under the Freedom of Information Act. And right now we are in the Court of Appeals where the case was argued in September and we're awaiting decision. And in that case, we're seeking documents from the CIA about civilian casualties of drone strikes abroad and the targeting killing program, as well as other information that the government has about that program. And in that case, the CIA has consistently and still to this day claimed that it cannot confirm or deny that it even has records responsive to this request based on national security grounds. And that, of course, is becoming increasingly unbelievable by the day, as we just had a hearing last week about the new CIA director that was largely focused on the CIA's use of drones in the targeted killing program. The accountability arm of our litigation right now involves a lawsuit brought with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York on behalf of the families of 3 American citizens who were killed in Yemen in drone strikes in 2011. In that case, we are seeking a constitutional remedy for violations of the U.S. citizens who are now deceased constitutional rights under the 4th and 5th Amendment. And earlier, a few years ago, also with the Center for Constitutional Rights, we brought a lawsuit to enjoin the government, to stop the government from killing Anwar al-Awlaki, the son of our plaintiff in that past lawsuit and in this new lawsuit. I mean, in that case, the judge decided that Anwar al-Awlaki's father did not have standing to bring that claim, and then, of course, the government later killed Anwar al-Awlaki.
Brett Kaufman, it seems from what we know so far that John Brennan, President Obama's counterterrorism chief, and President Obama himself are the ones looking at a proposed list of people who are suspected terrorists that are to be killed by these drones and making decisions in a weekly meeting. Is this really the process that the United States is going through to select people to assassinate around the world? Is this what it comes down to, two individual people's decision?
It appears that it does, and in the words of the memo, an informed high-level official of the U.S. government must determine that the targeted individual poses an imminent threat of violent attack against the United States. So it really does come down, apparently, to the say-so of one individual in the executive branch with an unknown standard of evidence and through an unknown, closed, secret executive process. And I might add that the government is claiming all this authority, while at the same time refusing to discuss it publicly, to reveal the standards and the process that it's using to allow Americans to publicly debate what kind of limitations are in place in the executive branch. And it is also fighting the ability of individuals to, even after the fact, hold officials accountable for wrongful killings of American citizens.
Brett, when it comes to what was stated during the confirmation hearing for John Brennan, as President Obama has nominated him to become the next head of the CIA, are there any signs that members of the U.S. Senate are looking to get some oversight over this program in a serious way, or was this just a lot of rustling of papers and hot air?
Well, certainly certain senators have been seeking this information for a very long time, and the administration should have released it to them and the public a very long time ago. But it was encouraging to see the White House at least provide limited access to the senators on the Intelligence Committee before the hearing, although immediately, as announced in the hearing, Chairman Feinstein mentioned that there were 8 memos that had not been released, and she was upset about that, and Senator Wyden's been another big leader on this issue. But the truth is that these memos should be released to the public and not just the committees, because when the government's claiming authority to kill Americans, the public should be able to see all of its arguments and debate them openly in order to see what the limits are that the government's purportedly placing on its authority.
That was Brett Kaufman, National Security Fellow with the ACLU's National Security Project. Find more perspectives on the Obama administration's drone warfare program on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.com. When President Obama signed the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, civil liberties advocates were alarmed at several provisions, including Section 1021, that empowers the current and all future presidents to indefinitely imprison U.S. citizens and non-citizens who were part of or substantially supported al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or associated forces that are engaged in hostilities against the United States or its coalition partners. Persons accused under this provision can be held by the U.S. military indefinitely or transferred to any nation in the world without charge, trial, or access to an attorney. On January 13th last year, two lawyers, Carl J. Mayer and Bruce I. Afrin, filed a lawsuit on behalf of 7 plaintiffs challenging the legality of what they assert are unconstitutional provisions of the NDAA. Their plaintiffs in the case, known as Hedges v. Obama, include former New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and America's most well-known dissident and MIT linguist Noam Chomsky. On May 16th last year, U.S. District Judge for the Southern District of New York, Catherine Forrest, issued a preliminary injunction that barred the U.S. government from applying indefinite military detention of U.S. citizens. Later on September 12th, Judge Forrest issued a permanent injunction declaring Section 1021 of the NDAA unconstitutional. In response, the Obama administration appealed the decision to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which issued a stay of the injunction pending the outcome of the government's case. Your reporter spoke with Carl Mayer, one of the two attorneys in the case, who talks about oral arguments made before the 3-judge panel of the appellate court in New York City on February 6th.
The law is unconstitutional. It goes against our most basic principles. Judge Forrest not only granted a preliminary injunction, but she granted a permanent injunction back in September. As soon as Judge Forrest granted the permanent injunction, the Obama Justice Department went crazy. They, at 11 o'clock on a Friday night, they indicated they were filing papers first thing on the following Monday morning, asking for a stay of the Judge Forrest opinion, and they immediately appealed it. And that's, in fact, what they did do. And unfortunately, the Second Circuit, which is the appellate court, federal appellate court, did grant them a stay until the appeal was heard. And the appeal was heard February 6th in the Second Circuit Court of Appeal in Manhattan, which is the highest court before the Supreme Court of the United States. That's where we are. We're waiting for the Second Circuit Court of Appeals to decide. We have vowed that whichever way this turns out, if we prevail, we will call on the Obama administration to stop this program of the military policing our streets. If we don't prevail, we will seek to have the Supreme Court rule on this.
Carl, can you tell our listeners a bit about the efforts in Congress last year to amend the 2013 NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act, to be very specific, to exclude U.S. citizens from the purview of the U.S. government to detain them indefinitely? And those efforts, from what I remember, were unsuccessful.
That's correct. When the legislation was first passed at the end of 2011, it immediately became obvious, in the words of Brigadier General David Tice and 40 other retired admirals and generals, that this was the most major change in counterterrorism since 9/11, because now the military are being asked to police our streets. These former admirals and generals were appalled by this. They said flat out, the military does many things well. Policing our streets is not one of them. So almost immediately after the bill's passage, besides the filing of our lawsuit, members of Congress went to work trying to amend it to protect citizens and other civilians within the United States. There was a year-long debate. The politicians did their thing, which is to pound their chests, make lots of noise, and in the end, nothing happened. Citizens and civilians were left unprotected. They couldn't even get into the bill a language that specifically said that anyone who was detained would have the right to habeas review, which is to petition the court to review their case after they've already been detained. But, you know, frankly, habeas is already in the Constitution, and the fact that the Congress couldn't even pass something that's already guaranteed people in the Constitution is really boggles my mind. But in any event, that failed, which is why we're pressing on with our lawsuit. The politicians aren't going to get the job done. We'll get the job done.
We are in the midst of a new controversy that's erupted into the public sphere recently, although it's been around quite some time, and that is the Obama administration's drone program. But it seems to me that this NDAA provision giving the government the right to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens is inextricably linked with the Obama administration's self-declaration that they have the right to kill any American citizen anywhere in the world without any due process. It's frightening and stunning all at the same time.
We haven't seen the memorandum. We've just seen a sort of summary of the president's memorandum supposedly providing a legal rationale for the drone strikes. But the terms used in that memorandum are quite similar to the terms used in the NDAA. The drone memorandum talks about associated forces, meaning essentially that drones can go after anyone who's a, quote, associated force of Al-Qaeda, which could be anything. What is the definition of an associated force? And same with the NDAA. Anyone who supports an associated force of Al-Qaeda or an associated force of any group that's engaged in hostilities with any of our coalition partners, that's the nature of it. It is completely open-ended. It is completely inchoate. It is completely a violation of the Due Process Clause of the Constitution. And that's why we're trying to stop it. But the idea that the executive can do all of this without judicial review was most aggressively pursued by President Bush, or Bush II, George W. Bush. But Obama has gone even farther than George W. Bush. I don't understand what people are thinking in this area. that, you know, they elect Obama because they think he's going to stand up, and he's promised to stand up to the Bush administration record on civil rights, civil liberties, and then he does worse than the Bush administration on civil rights, civil liberties. It's mind-boggling. You know, when are Democratic Party voters going to get it in their mind that, fine, if you want to spend a few hours trying to make sure that you get President Obama in who is better than the troglodyte Republicans, that's fine. But then don't give him a pass on civil liberties and just sit on your hands and say, oh, well, he's a Democrat, so he'll take care of our civil liberties, because he's not taking care of our civil liberties.
That was Carl J. Mayer, one of two attorneys representing seven plaintiffs in the Hedges versus Obama case, challenging the government's power to indefinitely detain U.S. citizens. For more analysis on this case, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The December 14th massacre of 20 young children and six educators at Newtown, Connecticut's Sandy Hook Elementary School has provoked a national debate and soul-searching about how best to stop America's epidemic of gun violence, but nowhere more than in the state where the tragedy occurred. Since the Newtown mass shooting, Connecticut legislators have convened several task forces to reconsider the state's gun laws, the availability of mental health treatment, school safety, and have introduced dozens of bills to address those issues. Large numbers of people from across the state have participated in vigils for the dead, attended rallies, meetings, and public hearings. A recent public forum held at an inner-city library branch in New Haven featured a panel that included the director of a youth coalition, the leader of a national organization of African-American police officers, a criminal justice reform advocate, and Marty Isaac, president of the group Connecticut Against Gun Violence Education Fund. The 20-year-old organization has focused its attention on gun violence in the state's inner cities, where, for example, 34 people in New Haven were murdered in 2011. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Isaac after the forum. Here he explains how longtime gun safety advocates from the state have welcomed new mostly suburban activists to the cause in the wake of the Newtown shootings and changes to firearms laws Connecticut Against Gun Violence is advocating for in the state legislature.
What I've seen time and again are the people that have entered recently are just shocked when they learn of the violence that's happening through the country. So, you know, maybe they got involved because they weren't aware before and they've been shocked that all these babies were killed. And it's so horrendous. But when they begin to hear the numbers of, you know, 12,000 murders in this country and so much happening in the inner cities, they're aghast. They didn't know it. And many people, they're almost ashamed that they weren't in this fight earlier. And we welcome them. I see the inner city, the urban communities joining. I see the suburban folks coming on board because everyone is so upset at gun violence in this country. And they look at it. It's not about that you can't own a gun. You can own a gun, but you need to be responsible and do it in a responsible manner. You know, I see where there's common ground. And I'm talking gun owner, non-gun owner. Where there's common ground is on this universal background check. It doesn't make any sense you can buy a weapon, even in a private sale, without being certain that they're eligible to have a weapon. Where I'm seeing common ground is where people are saying you need to have a permit to have any type of firearm. You need to have a permit to have any to purchase ammunition. Why shouldn't you? And where I'm also seeing common ground, and there's a fringe that certainly is not in agreement with this, but when I'm saying common ground, I'm saying from the hunter, from the sportsman, the traditional gun owners, they don't see a reason why you should have a higher capacity ammunition magazine. It doesn't make any sense to them. They don't see a reason why you need to have these, you know, what I call, you know, assault-style weapons. They don't see any reason why these need to be in the civilian hands. So I see, you know, the legislative effort, the agenda that we're putting forward for Connecticut Against Gun Violence is accepted by most people in Connecticut. You know, there's been polls that have come out recently where it's almost our legislative agenda. It's almost as if it was polled. And overwhelming majority of people are saying, yes, we need these common sense changes to our gun laws.
So reiterate what your asks are.
Yeah, well, there's around eight of them. But, you know, first and foremost, it's ban these assault-style weapons, ban high-capacity ammunition magazines. And when I talk about banning, we're saying not just the future sale. We're saying remove them from the state. And it's important, because if all you do is ban the future sale, you're saying the Connecticut of December 14th is acceptable. It's not acceptable. We don't want to live like this. We're saying, no, you need to find a solution to get these out of the state. We're talking about a permit for ammunition. We're talking about universal background checks for any gun sold, whether it's done from a formal dealer or done at a private sale. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about a registration system for firearms, so you affirm you can have as many firearms as you want, but affirm that you have these firearms. We need to stop this trafficking. How can it be these guns are legally purchased initially, and they end up in these violent situations? There's two crimes at these crime scenes. It's a crime that's done, and where did they get this gun? A registration system could go a long way to solving those issues.
The number of guns that have been purchased since, well, partly when Obama took office the first time, but also especially since Newtown, I mean, it's like record every week. It's a record number of registrations or, you know, background checks requested because people want to buy it. Now they're running out of the guns to sell, is what I heard today. So are you talking about taking back either guns or ammunition clips or ammunition?
We're talking about the urgency for the legislative groups to act and get these laws changed, because you're right, every single day more of these weapons are being sold. And there's going to be a time, you know, there's a lot to be worked out. What is the right way to implement this? My point is, if you're simply banning future sale, then you're saying that the Connecticut of December 14th is okay for Connecticut. And I think the uproar you've seen from people throughout the state and really throughout the country are saying that's not okay. That's not an acceptable solution. It's better than doing nothing to stop future sale. But that's not a satisfactory solution to where we stand today.
But do you think there's any chance at all, like even a 1% chance, that any law would be passed that would allow law enforcers, if people didn't turn in those things, to go in and get them? I mean, I just, you know, that's what they did in Australia. They made it illegal to own the weapons, and people turned them in and were paid for their weapons, but they made it illegal to own them.
I think there are a number of solutions in terms of how you would work this out, and I'll leave it to the lawmakers to decide the best way of making this work. But the point is, people are demanding a change to where we stand today in Connecticut, and, you know, if you don't do that, we're really not acting in a significant fashion.
That was Marty Isaac, president of the group Connecticut Against Gun Violence Education Fund. Find links to more commentary about the debate on gun laws in Connecticut and the nation on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.